What has been the impact of decades of genetic manipulation of staple crops on human health, farming as a livelihood, and on the sustainability of our food supply? Who benefits from the GMO revolution? How did Monsanto and the other biotech companies come into existence in the first place? Do they have an agenda beyond making agriculture more efficient and sustainable? On today's show, we'll hear from Canadian activist and researcher Sandra Finley about how Canadians have been and continue to be impacted by the revolution in agriculture. We will hear an excerpt of a speech by Dr. Vandana Shiva on impacts in India, and author and geopolitical analyst William Engdahl provides the hidden background outlining the real motivations behind the GMO movement. On today's show, Seeds of Destruction, the record of Monsanto and genetic manipulation. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 23rd, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The World Social Forum at its inaugural meeting defined itself as a counter-offensive to the World Economic Forum of business leaders and politicians which meet annually in Davos, Switzerland. Yet upon careful review, the WSF, rather than effectively confronting the economic and financial elites, actually serves their interests. The anti-globalization movement is opposed to Wall Street and the Texas oil giants controlled by Rockefeller et al. Yet the foundations and charities of Ford, Rockefeller et al. Will generously fund progressive, anti-capitalist networks as well as environmentalists opposed to Wall Street and Big Oil, with a view to ultimately overseeing and shaping their various activities. The mechanisms of manufacturing dissent require a manipulative environment, a process of arm-twisting and subtle co-optation of a small number of key individuals within progressive organizations, including anti-war coalitions, environmentalists, and the anti-globalization movement. That was from an article, "The Anti-Globalization Movement and the World Social Forum. Is Another World Possible?" by Professor Michelle Chosadovsky, dated May 15. The official story is that the Korean War began when the Soviet-backed North invaded the South on June 25, 1950. Korea, division, reunification, and the U.S. foreign policy notes, "The best explanation of what happened on June 25th is that Syngman Rhee deliberately initiated the fighting and then successfully blamed the North. The North eagerly waited for provocation, took advantage of the southern attack, and without incitement by the Soviet Union, launched its own strike with the objective of capturing Seoul." Cold War Canada summarizes the incredible violence unleashed by UN forces in Korea. Quote, "The monstrous effects on Korean civilians of the methods of warfare adopted by the United Nations, the blanket firebombing of North Korean cities, the destruction of dams and the resulting devastation of the food supply, and an unremitting aerial bombardment more intensive than anything experienced during the Second World War. Even to a world that had just begun to recover from the vast devastation of the Second World War, Korea was a man-made hell, with a place among the most violent excesses of the 20th century." That was from an article by Eve Engler entitled "The Korean Atrocity, Forgotten U.S. War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanity," posted May 18th and originally appearing in Fourth World. For almost 5 years, the world's major central banks have pumped an estimated $7 trillion into financial markets with the stated aim of trying to spark an economic recovery. The statistics on price levels are among the most significant. These show that rather than prices increasing, a sign of recovery in so-called normal conditions, deflationary pressures are intensifying. Confronted with falling prices for their products, major firms and corporations seek to make profits not by investing and expanding production, as they would seek to do if a recovery were underway, but by savage cost-cutting coupled with financial speculation. The subsequent cuts in pay and jobs lead to a reduction in consumer demand, further fueling the deflationary trend. That was from an article entitled Systemic Breakdown, Financial Bubbles Creating Conditions for New Crash by Nick Beams, posted May 21st and originally published on the World Socialist website. But the U.S. still maintains Camp Bondsteel and Camp Monteith. The first, Camp Bondsteel, is reportedly the largest overseas U.S. military base built since the war in Vietnam, and it was built on Serbian land without consulting with the government of Serbia. And evidently, somebody with the Council of Europe, Alvaro Gil Robles, human rights envoy to the Council of Europe, referred to Camp Bondsteel in 2005, and this is a quote, as a smaller version of Guantanamo after visiting the facility. So evidently, the U.S. did use it for extraordinary renditions and so-called black operations or black sites. That's from Europe's Little Guantanamo, Why the U.S. Wants Serbia to Give Up Kosovo, a transcription of an interview by John Robles with Rick Rozoff for Voice of Russia, posted to Global Research May 18th. Gangjiang villagers last night were removed while protecting tents they had long used just across the road from the Navy base construction gate on Jeju Island, South Korea. The government appears to be continuing with its fierce crackdown since the election of the new president, Park Geun-hye, the daughter of the former brutal South Korean dictator who had once served as an officer in the Japanese Imperial Army. Navy plans reveal that they intend to take significant portions of the village for military personnel housing once the port facilities are complete. This base will be a key port for the U.S. Navy that is now moving 60% of its forces to the Asia-Pacific as part of Obama's dangerous and destabilizing military pivot into the region. Gangjiang Village sits just 300 miles from the Chinese mainland, making the proposed Navy base there a strategic outpost for the Pentagon's goal of controlling the shipping lanes which China uses to import 80% of its oil. That was from an article by Bruce Gagnon of spaceforpeace.org entitled, America Threatens Eastern China, Jeju Island Key Strategic Naval Base for America's Asia Pivot. Posted May 18th, originally published in Fourth Media. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The smallest component of any organism is the single cell, which contains the coding for how that organism will develop. That coding is known as the genome. Decades ago, scientists learned how to manipulate that coding by taking pieces of the DNA molecule and transplanting it into the genome of other organisms. This process is known as genetic engineering and has been applied broadly within the field of agriculture, presumably to improve the food supply and food production. The final product is known as the genetically modified organism, or GMO. Monsanto is the seed company that is most closely associated with this kind of manipulation on a grand scale and has used the technology to make plants more resistant to herbicides like Roundup, which is also a Monsanto product. We will hear more about why this technology was applied in practice, but first, we will hear more about its impacts in the Canadian context. Sandra Finley is the former leader of the Green Party of Saskatchewan. She is an activist, researcher, and elected member of the University of Saskatchewan Senate. She has written extensively on the subject of Monsanto and GMOs, among other issues, and is to speak Saturday, May 25th, at a public event in solidarity with the worldwide March Against Monsanto Day of Action. She will be attending and speaking at that march, starting at 12 noon local time at Kinsman Park. She joins us by phone. So, Sandra Finley, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Michael. Good to be back.
Yes. Now, you are a lifelong Saskatchewanian, if I'm not mistaken.
I was born here and grew up, but I did live for 15 years in Nova Scotia.
Oh, okay. I see. But you certainly have a good, strong recollection of life growing up in rural Saskatchewan.
Yes, absolutely.
Could you tell us maybe how things have changed, how the communities in rural Saskatchewan have altered in your lifetime as a result of this, I guess, industrialization of agriculture?
One thing that I notice, Michael, when I'm back in Luseland, Saskatchewan, where I grew up, is that if I walk out on the prairie, which is along the railway tracks, when I was young, there would be all kinds of meadowlarks singing. A day wouldn't go by without you hearing them. And now it's rare. I can go for a few years and not hear a meadowlark. That's one big change. With respect to agriculture, the other big change that I see is a change in the healthiness of the population. One time I was home, it was near Christmas time, and my mother was giving me the update on people in the community, and she started to list the people who had cancer, and some of whom had recently passed away from cancer. Some of it was diagnosis in September, dead in December. Those disease rates simply weren't there when I was young, and the town hasn't grown very much. The population there has been fairly stable. So, and some of the people who have died are relatively young. So you have that. You have also in that town very high levels of MS. And that was a disease that we didn't even know of back when. Parkinson's disease is another big ticket disease in the community. So those are just some of the things that I focus on. And the, it's backed, so those are my observations, but they're all so backed up by information. I mean, it's known widely that breast cancer among rural women is higher. Here in Saskatoon, this goes back 10 years, I was introduced to Canada's top oncology radiologist who had worked for a year in Regina and then a year in Saskatoon. She told me that there was a developing epidemic of prostate cancer. Well, no, she did not say prostate cancer. A developing epidemic of cancer among farm men. And she was quite disturbed by the amount of cancer that they were discovering in her work. It's further reinforced by the work of Dr. Elizabeth Gillette, who in 2003 was on David Suzuki's Toxic Legacies, and she had been in the Yaqui Valley in Mexico, where they put out two crops a year of fruits and vegetables, using the same many of the same chemicals as we're using here in Saskatchewan. And she did research into the impacts on children in those communities, and her research is very compelling, and it's been duplicated since then. So what is happening in the country is that we are upping the dosing of chemicals, and that dosing comes with the biotechnology, the genetically modified crops, they are modified to withstand chemical applications. But as we all know, I mean, if you look at something like antibiotic resistance, we know that nature evolves. So what we're getting is super weeds and super bugs. Roundup was the chemical of choice. It was Monsanto's Roundup resistance that is engineered into these plants. And so now you can, you know, fields can be sprayed with Roundup, but it won't kill the weeds, and they have to now use, on top of the Roundup, for example, 2,4-D. So you're getting more and more chemicals, and not only that, they are more toxic. They have to be, because they've got to kill the plants that are resistant to, you know, what some might think of as being a lower level of poison.
So Sandra Finley, I mean, you're indicating that farmers are and farm families are getting sicker as a result of this new chemical kind of agriculture. Do you see any other changes in terms of the economic dimension or just community relations?
Yeah, well, what you see, of course, is that emptying out of rural Saskatchewan. If towns aren't dying, it would be because there's oil and gas activity. What's happened is that the farmers who have survived have gotten larger and larger with larger and larger equipment and much more dependence on technology. The consequence of that is that you get a hollowing out of the services that are in the community. It's very difficult for small communities to even be able to support, for example, the technology. You know, if you've got a broken down machine, it's not likely that it's going to be fixed in the immediate town. If it's, you know, depending on the size of it, of course. But you've got movement. You hollow out your economic activity in the town too. It becomes much more centralized.
Is there a friendly relationship between Monsanto and farmers?
Very often, yes. They're very skillful at training youngsters to go out and support their products. There's, if you drive out in the country, there's lots of big advertising billboards. If you turn on a rural radio station, you will get lots of advertising from Monsanto. And of course, in publications, there will be a big promotion as well. I think that the relationship is weakening, that farmers are starting to say, maybe this wasn't such a good idea, because, you know, they promised in early years, they promised things like higher yields. Well, the higher yields didn't actually materialize. And what the farmers find is that they are going bigger and bigger, but they're not making more money. And there again, the research shows very clearly that, yes, there's more revenue generated through, agriculture on the prairies, but what is going to the farmers has stayed the same. It has not increased at all. So what's happening is that the farmers are, they've gotten bigger and bigger and felt that they had to, because that's the mantra that's preached. But, you know, you have to get bigger in order to sell more so you can cover your costs. Well, what's happened is they do all that, and so they're on a real treadmill. But really, the extra money is all going to those large corporations like Monsanto or Bayer Crop Science or Dow or Syngenta, whatever. It's not going into the farmers' pockets.
And it's setting farmer against farmer?
In cases, absolutely, sure. Especially the people that wanted to do the non-chemical, non-GMO agriculture, because you get the, you know, they lose the ability to grow those crops. Canola is a perfect example. I don't want to always use canola because there's other examples as well. Triffid flax was another one. The flax growers in the late 1990s, early 2000s, spent a lot of effort persuading people that, look, you cannot introduce GMO flax because we will lose all of our European markets. And Europe takes a huge percentage of the flax. And they were successful for a time, but then, lo and behold, there was a researcher actually at the university who developed this Triffid flax and wanted it to get out there. And it was stopped. It was supposed to all have been destroyed. But a number of years later, the Europeans found GMO flax in the flax coming from Canada. It was a huge cost to the flax growers, and the flax growers who don't have any GMO flax are, you know, like, still very much determined to keep the GMO flax out. But those corporations work very hard to get that GMO crop in. They want control of all of the crops. They're not content with what they have. They want more.
Sandra Finley, you sit on the University of Winnipeg, University of Saskatchewan Senate, if I'm not mistaken. What are your observations with regard to how having an entity like Monsanto active within the university of a community, how has that affected research?
I'm going to take a bit of advantage of your question, Michael. First of all, there is a skewing of the research. And when the University of Saskatchewan built a new College of Agriculture back in the 1980s, Monsanto contributed $11 million to the construction of the building. That was $11 million then was huge, you know, more so than it is today. And they also helped fund the research. I've talked with professors who were in the College of Agriculture interested in alternatives to the chemical biotech agriculture, but they get absolutely marginalized. And more recently, I attended a lecture at the university, and it was research related to genetically modified crops, and the research could be quite easily questioned, seriously challenged, if you knew background such as, like, for example, in the United States, the rice growers took Dow to court and got $1 million settlements because of the contamination of their crops by GM rice. The research presented said that, oh, you know, wherever there's an introduction of a GM crop, that it's so wonderful that all the farmers will embrace the GM crop. Well, actually, you know, as explained earlier, it's not that everybody embraces these crops. It is that they don't have a choice because of that contamination factor. And also, I think what's happening is that farmers, because they've tried the GM, found that it isn't the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, as it's told to them. What's happening is that they are resisting and trying to keep the genetically modified crops, new ones, out. You have that happening with wheat, with alfalfa, as I used that rice example. So what happens is you get very skewed research. And then in that environment, if you have, you know, some of the students are get fed one diet, and it's a chemical biotech diet. So what I found sitting in an audience of colleagues of the researcher and students of agriculture, there's they either, I use the word sycophants. There's nobody there that's going to even ask the hard questions because they are concerned about their rise in, you know, in influence or in the organization. The other thing that's happening that is a very serious issue, and here's where I'm taking advantage of your question, what you have happening at the University of Saskatchewan is that the government partnered with a corporation, and together they gave $50 million to the University of Saskatchewan. Now, any money that comes to a university should not be designated funding, but what we are getting is designated funding. The university is told here is $50 million for the Global Institute on Food Security. Global Institute on Food Security. What it is, and it's not too hard to, you know, find out by asking a few questions and by looking at where the people are coming from that are peopling that institute, is it's a vehicle for doing the research, meeting the research requirement for the chemical biotech corporations. And because what's happening is there is research coming out now that seriously challenges their claims about the efficacy of their products, and also serious challenges to the health-giving aspects of those products, to the point where, I mean, they are undermining health. And so what you know is that if you set up a global institute and it's to meet the research requirements of the chemical biotech corporations, what you're going to get is simply more, I would call it industry-contaminated research. It's not bona fide. Those corporations control the agenda. They control what research gets done and what doesn't get done.
Sandra Finley, is there any legislation or any other developments that you'd like to bring to the attention of our listeners with regard to Monsanto and GMOs?
Absolutely, and thank you. May the 23rd is the deadline for input to the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They are in the process of making changes to the seed variety registration in Canada. And if the changes that they want go through, there will be more corporate control of the crops that are being grown. There are two places that I would direct people to for more information. One of them is called CBAM, Canadian Biotechnology Action Network. But CBAM, you can Google that and you'll find them. They've got a good page on it, and or the National Farmers Union. There's a letter that people can put their name and address to and submit it to the government. In the past, we've been frustrated because often you participate, but there's no benefit. The decisions will still be made in favor of the corporate interest. But I think maybe the world is changing. The Americans said, the Food and Drug Administration had put through what is called the Monsanto Protection Act, whereby, if Monsanto's products were shown to be compromising health and having difficulties, there couldn't be any court action against them. And what's happened is that there is such outrage, so much petitioning of Congress, that it's looking as though that is going to be repealed. It was in an omnibus bill, kind of buried, but the activists in the U.S. have been very successful at drawing attention and mobilizing people to stop it. So I'm hopeful that maybe in Canada we will be able to do the same thing.
Well, on that hopeful note, I think we'll probably leave it there. Sandra Finley, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thanks, Michael, and have a good day.
You as well.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Sandra Finley is the former leader of the Green Party of Saskatchewan, an activist, researcher, and elected member of the University of Saskatchewan Senate, and will be participating in this Saturday, May the 25th, Saskatoon Action in March Against Monsanto event. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Vandana Shiva is a world-renowned scientist, feminist, ecologist, and author. She is one of the world's leading critics of Monsanto and GMO agriculture and runs the India-based biodiversity conservation program known as Navdanya. Here she is from a 2009 keynote address to the Organicology Conference in Portland, Oregon.
So our relationship now is very, very intimate because it's the same companies that are preventing American farmers from having access to seed and are preventing Indian farmers from not just having access to seed, but having access to life. The first GM crop introduced into India was in 98, and it's the BT cotton. I just call it the pesticide cotton. The BT cotton was brought in by Monsanto, and Monsanto put these arrogant ads in the newspapers about how Indian farmers would have boll guard. So I started to ring up the ministries and said, have they sought approval? And of course, nobody had been checked, because Monsanto had worked in dismantling laws in this country, so there's no regulation on genetic engineering in the US at all. It's a deregulated sector. And Monsanto thought you can walk into any country and assume there is no regulation, but we do have regulation. And so I took them to court, I sued them, took them to the Supreme Court, and the introduction was delayed up to 2005. Since 2005, they've started to sell BT cotton, and in certain areas, there's only BT cotton available now. These are the areas where the farmers have where we have the highest rate of farmer suicides. In the last decade, during which seed monopolies were established, during which the global players started to buy up Indian companies or have licensing arrangements with them, we have lost more than 200,000 farmers in suicides. We've, of course, lost 8 million farmers who've had to leave the land. And it's a combination of seed monopolies and falling prices linked to the subsidies, the $4 billion in the case of cotton, and the unfair trade rules. It is a genocidal packet that must destroy farmers, and doesn't kill farmers metaphorically, it kills farmers biologically. We started 2 years ago to work in this area. And the interesting thing is, by shifting to organic, the farmers are earning 10 times more than the BT cotton farmers, even though every advertisement of Monsanto talks about how farmers earn more with GM crops. And that's also very interesting. You know, my mind kind of gets very troubled every time I see a huge inconsistency. So why should you have seed monopolies for cheap food? Costly seed, cheap food. Something must be going funny in the middle. You get farmers to pay higher royalties and they're supposed to have higher incomes. How? The aim of the seed industry is $1 trillion of profits from royalties every year. And the aim is no farmer should have access to their own seed. The aim is every farmer should be forced into the market every year.
Joining us now to discuss the question of genetic modification and provide us a little bit of background on that technology and on the company Monsanto is geopolitical analyst, author, and economist William Engdahl. He is the author of Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation. So thank you for joining us, William Engdahl.
Thank you.
Now, as I read your book, I find that it seems as if the whole issue of genetic engineering, it seems like it's not unlike water fluoridation and the chemical, the use of chemical pesticides and herbicides. This idea of a solution looking for a problem that's developed during wartime. Could you maybe help our listeners understand a little bit about how genetic engineering came to be as an element of our agricultural reality?
Well, the GMO project was started by the Rockefeller Foundation, the same people who created the world cartel in oil multinationals, the first real multinationals, I suppose, if you want to look at it that way. And after World War II, Nelson Rockefeller, one of the brothers, went with Norman Borlaug, who was working for the Rockefeller University at the time as a researcher, to Mexico and South America, where the Rockefeller family had huge oil and other interests. And he had the idea to introduce wheat hybrids, so-called miracle wheat, into agriculture in Mexico and other developing countries with an eye to industrialization of the agriculture there, similar to what was going on in the American agriculture north of the Rio Grande. And the Rockefeller Foundation financed a project called Agribusiness at Harvard Business School in the 1950s. Now, what does this have to do with patenting seeds and genetically modifying plants? Well, I think it has everything to do, if you look at it as an historical process, because the idea of creating a top-down vertical integration, a monopoly concentration in food production in the same way that the Rockefeller Standard Oil Group had done with oil production was their dream. That was essentially the raison d'etre behind the agribusiness project at Harvard Business School, and precisely to create vertical integration where the actual physical farmer and the farm family, the family farm, would be the least relevant or important link in this whole chain, and the concentration would concentrate profits in for-profit-only stock companies like Conagra or Tyson Foods or such concentrates. And one of these is Monsanto, one of the core companies of the Rockefeller family holdings. So the idea of genetically manipulating, inserting a foreign bacteria or fungus into the genome or the DNA of a plant or of an animal or of a human, for that matter, is what they're trying now. This comes out of something called eugenics. And for people who don't know what eugenics is, it's the Nazi race science, the attempts by the Nazi doctors during the 1930s and into World War II to literally breed a master race through manipulating genes and eliminate the undesirable races, the so-called inferiors. And the eugenics projects of the Hitler Third Reich at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin and Munich and elsewhere, Dr. Mengele, the doctor of death as he's known in history, Joseph Mengele and others, this was financed by the Rockefeller Foundation, and they were quite open about it at the time. I mean, they didn't try to hide it. They do now, but it's too late because the archives have been researched thoroughly. After World War II, they had a conference. One of the prime sponsors of the American Eugenics Society was the Rockefeller family, the Rockefeller brothers, and the Rockefeller Foundation, financial sponsors. They held a conference. Someone close to the Rockefeller family was the president of the American Eugenics Society, and he said after World War II and the discovery of the Nuremberg and the Auschwitz gas ovens and so forth, the new name of eugenics will be genetics. And I think that says it all. So the idea of being able to tinker with life, to be able to play around with the DNA structure and modify it in some way, is a mad dream of a group of scientists sponsored by Rockefellers, and has been for decades, since probably before the end of World War II. And it's doomed to fail because you cannot manipulate life in that manner. It's based on scientific reductivism, and reductivism is simply false science, trying to force everything into the smallest imaginable glob of matter, a single gene, and claim that defines its characteristics. Well, genes, like human beings, are defined by their social environment, by their by the universe that they live in, not only by their own individual expression, and that's the fundamental flaw of GMO.
Yeah, obviously, I don't think too many people are very aware of that insidious background to this technology. In fact, the technology itself, it's not very well promoted, even though the people who develop it and try to promote it, it's not something that's promoted on the product itself. Certainly not they're trying to discourage labeling of genetically modification. You know, so I guess the question is then that who principally benefits from genetic modification? I mean, even in terms of who they're trying to direct this technology to. I mean, it's...
Well, I'm gonna give a little bit of a shocking own conclusion on this. People who are interested in a detailed explanation of it should get the book and read it. Not simply because I wrote the book, but it's the only place I know of where it's the case is laid out in such detailed form. But the labeling was put in place under George Father Bush in 1992 in a private meeting in the White House with the heads of Monsanto, the largest owner of patented seeds and the largest commercial seed owner in the world today. They've been buying up independent heritage seed companies wherever they can so that they can get this monopoly. And the goal, in my view, is to... Well, it goes back to a quote from Henry Kissinger attributed to him during the 1970s when we had an oil crisis and a food crisis. And Kissinger at that time said, if you control the food, you control the people. And I think that's precisely what certain powerful elite circles are trying to do with patenting of seeds, of GMO seeds. If you control the patents on rice seeds that are grown in China or Asia, and soybean seeds and corn seeds that are one of the main crops in U.S. agriculture, and certainly the main source of animal feed in the world today in the commercial agriculture. If you control the patents on those, you have the potential to control entire governments, like what Kissinger imposed on Chile during the Allende regime. He imposed, if food is a weapon, he cut off USAID food supplies that led to growing popular demonstrations against Allende that gave the cover for the military coup that Kissinger wanted in Chile.
Mr. Engdahl, I just want, sorry to interrupt, but I just remember at the outset you were talking about the Rockefellers and oil, and I seem to recall that the Marshall Plan, I mean, one of the effects of that, whether it was intended or not, is it shifted the base of industrial production away from coal to oil, correct? In Europe?
Well, yeah, Europe after the... World War II, Europe was a predominantly coal-driven economy, and what happened is that the Marshall Plan was used to, in large part, transform agriculture, mechanized agriculture with tractors and so forth, using Rockefeller Standard Oil. They got the lion's share of the oil markets across Europe after the war, and transform Europe's economy from coal to petroleum, which was the Rockefeller game.
And as I think you were saying, that it seems as if this transformation, like what they did for oil, now they're wanting to do for food production. So it's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. Just get, if they control the seeds, they can deny the seeds. The seeds are licensed. You sign an agreement with Monsanto. Let's take them as an example because they're the biggest. And in that agreement, you have to agree only to use Monsanto seeds that you buy each planting season from Monsanto anew, and you have to use a Monsanto patented Roundup weed killer. Now, Roundup, Monsanto refuses to release the list of ingredients in Roundup other than to say it's based on glyphosate, which is a highly toxic herbicide to begin with. But what they've done is add various adjuvants to the glyphosate that make it one of the most toxic brews cocktails out there. And there have been tests by scientists at Caen University in France under Gilles-Éric Seralini and his team that have tested the effects of Monsanto Roundup in doses less than what you have in your garden. Roundup is the most widely sold weed killer in the world today. And in doses less than are common in the garden, it kills cells in a human embryo. So that's pretty scary stuff. And that is tied in with the purchase of Monsanto seeds. And now what Monsanto is doing is a terror campaign, I think you have to call it, across the United States, that farmers who have a field next to a Monsanto GMO field, and the wind carries some of the seeds from the GMO field over into the non-GMO field, Monsanto will send private detectives around, kind of bounty hunters, to make crop tests of the neighboring farm. And if they find evidence of GMO, then they'll sue that farmer for stealing Monsanto seeds when the wind is what brought it over. And they knowingly do this in order to terrorize farmers into accepting GMO seeds.
Now, the technology, that there has been scientific research that's been conducted that attests to the hazards of this technology, if I'm not mistaken. Yet that has not done much to discourage this enterprise. Are we talking about a similar phenomenon to the way the tobacco industry has been able to suppress research pointing to its harmful impacts on human health?
Well, it's similar, but let's take it directly for what has happened. Monsanto has refused, for any independent test, they've refused to make their GMO seeds available to laboratories anywhere in the world. And that's even been the subject of a critical editorial in the American Science magazine, but the Scientific American. But the finally, in September 2012, in Food and Chemical Toxicology, and keep in mind the name of the journal, Toxicology, and a very respected scientific trade journal, they released a study by scientists in France, led by Professor Seralini, and the study was immediately posted on the internet to outflank Monsanto and their agri-lobby, and they did the world's first ever two-year-long feeding study, long-term study, with 200 rats on a diet with control groups and non-control, a diet of GMO corn. And what they found, and this was all peer-reviewed, and it was scientifically completely rigorous, and what they found was absolutely alarming. It should have killed the licensing of GMO for once and for all, pending repetition of the Seralini study by other independent scientists. Rats developed tumors, not after 90 days, which is the longest studies that Monsanto ever did on any of its GMO crops, but in some cases after 4 months or 8 or 9 months. But they developed horrendous rates of tumors, cancer tumors. They developed organ damage. They developed unbelievable... death rate on the rats that were fed GMO were something like 2 to 5 times higher than non-GMO rats. So all of the indications pointed a flashing red light. Let's make a full stop here on further licensing of GMO from the Food and Agriculture FDA in the United States or the USDA. Really examine this, have a moratorium on it, and examine in great detail what the long-term effects are in over a two-year period. Well, instead of that being done, the European Commission in Brussels, which is a body whose middle name is corruption, I would venture to say today, The European Commission in Brussels, which is the kind of the administrative, non-elected heart of the European Union, they dutifully gave it to the European Food Safety Administration, so-called experts, and six of the members of the EFSA panel that were supposed to review Seralini's study are members of front groups financed by Monsanto and the agribusiness GMO lobby. And what they did was issued after a few days, a few weeks, they issued a statement dismissing entirely the Seralini study, saying it's not biologically meaningful and therefore does not require further testing. Well, talk about a non-brainer. If this one study they claimed has scientific flaws, and they failed to enumerate the flaws in their report, well, then out of pure concern for human health and safety, they should have immediately said the European Union should finance several independent studies using the same parameters to confirm or disconfirm. Rather than that, they said let's close the case on this. Everything's okay. So this is an indication of the kind of corruption that Monsanto spent, and Monsanto and related GMO organizations spent. I've seen reports of over $100 million on the stopping the California labeling referendum some months back in the U.S. So this resembles more an organization of some kind of mafia than it does an honorable, serious company trying to improve the food supply for the world's population, which is their PR pitch, by the way.
So why did certain countries, especially Argentina, came to become major hubs for this new technology? Could you describe how Argentina, just for starters, came to be a major developer of this sure. soybeans, for example?
Well, in the early 90s, Argentina was in the midst of a grave debt crisis, the late 80s, early 90s. Carlos Menem was president. Carlos Menem, a personal family friend of David Rockefeller and the Bush family, both often guest at their homes, respectively. The Menem government gave Monsanto the exclusive, without any kind of congressional hearings or a debate or anything, made an agreement with Monsanto as the exclusive purveyor of GMO soybean seeds. At that time, Argentina was one of three large soybean growing areas in the world, the other being Brazil and the United States, North America, United States. And so with that, within a matter of a few years, soybeans took over Argentine agriculture, and soybeans grown by very large landowners, this medieval Spanish latifundista model, where you drive peasants off their land, you come in and use police to terrorize peasant families that have worked the land for generations, and bring in agribusiness and mechanized tractors with satellite guidance and remote control and so forth, so you need no labor power. And then you spray, you crop spray with Monsanto Roundup, and you create these huge poisonous concentrations of Monsanto soybeans across Argentina. And that's what's been done. It destroyed one of the most beautiful family agriculture systems in the world, which was the case of Argentina back in the 70s, in the early 80s.
Mm. Now, you do conclude the book by talking about, and of course you alluded to it earlier, that this issue, the agenda of population control. Could you help sort of seal that case? I mean,
sure.
It had its beginnings in eugenics, and now that we're seeing that move.
Well, many of the biggest investors in Monsanto, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which just bought millions of shares of Monsanto, are also some of the biggest advocates of population reduction. Bill Gates' father was a president of a eugenics organization, Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger's old organization, which is very close to the Rockefellers historically. That being neither here nor there, but the Gates Foundation is a major sponsor as well of bringing GMO into Africa under an organization headed up by Kofi Annan, the former United Nations Secretary General. project for a green revolution in Africa. And the green revolution they're talking about is nothing other than bringing patented seeds into traditional African agriculture and putting Africa, one of the most fertile lands on the planet that hasn't yet been destroyed from its soil nutrients and so forth by industrialized agriculture techniques, taking Africa and putting it under the thumb of U.S. agribusiness. And that would create an enormous power concentration. So the that's one aspect of it. The other is the role of the U.S. government in U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is an agency of the U.S. government, more or less run by agribusiness. No Secretary of Agriculture is approved in the Congress unless agribusiness behind the scenes gives them the green light or the thumbs up. And U.S. Department of Agriculture funded a project for creation with a company, a biotech company in San Diego, California, about a decade back, for creation of corn that was, and I pause and say this very slowly, spermicidal. And the president of that company, Episeed, actually gave a euphoric press conference before he was hushed up because it was a little bit too explosive politically. He gave a press conference and said, I have developed a solution to the world's overpopulation, namely spermicidal corn, genetically modified corn that kills human sperm when humans eat it. So that these are some of the indications. And I think it doesn't take a great stretch of the imagination to project, let's say, 10 to 20 years into the future when gradually the resistance, the political resistance in the European Union, already they've more or less bought the European commissioners to go for GMO, despite huge grassroots resistance across Europe. But Monsanto is determined to break the barrier in Europe and flood Europe with Monsanto patented seeds. Imagine that 10 years or 20 years down the road, China, Russia, India, and so are dominated by Monsanto-licensed GMO seeds or Syngenta or DuPont Dow Chemical, it doesn't matter, but it's all more or less functions as one cartel. The power that controls those seeds, the power that controls Monsanto, would then have the ability for the first time in history to cut off essential seeds for the further harvest, leaving aside all health dangers and so forth of GMO seeds and the chemicals that are paired with them. They would have such a power that no elite on Earth in human history has ever assembled, that kind of control over the food supply. Mm-hmm. So I think that it begins to suggest that we ought to be asking some of these kinds of questions in our public debate about GMO.
Well, William Engdahl, I want to really thank you for that analysis. It's definitely something that people should confront, given the importance of our food supply and maintaining some form of food sovereignty and control over what it is we put in our bellies and the way we do agriculture. So thank you very much for sharing those views with us.
Thank you.
And William Engdahl is the author of Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, and the book is available for sale through the globalresearch.ca website. Anyone wishing to participate in the worldwide May 25th actions against Monsanto should visit march-against-monsanto.com on the World Wide Web for information about events in your neighborhood. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.